our city, made viral all over the world, and we're going to get to the bottom of what did Hilton do, what have they changed, and what they're going to do down the road to make people feel safe in their lobbies.
Thank you. Listen, I'm E.D. Mondenay. Stay tuned tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock a.m. for Removing the Thorns on YouTube and our Facebook. And until then, we want to thank you for joining in, and we're encouraging all of Portland to stay strong.
Stay strong.
It's a thorn that needs a scold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on, get up, stand up.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Fight the Empire with Per Fogering.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 10 Spiders 30 EP release party on Saturday, October 10th at 8 p.m. at the White Eagle Saloon in Portland. 10 Spiders play bluesy roots rock and will be releasing their 30 EP that night. They'll be playing with Eco Check, an indie alt rock band, and Flying Caravan, who plays psych folk. Again, that's the 10 Spiders 30 EP release party on Saturday, October 10th at 8 p.m. at the White Eagle Saloon. 836 North Russell Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under community events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 10 Spiders 30 EP release party on Saturday, October 10th at 8 p.m. at the White Eagle Saloon in Portland. 10 Spiders play bluesy roots rock and will be releasing their 30 EP that night. They'll be playing with Eco Check, an indie alt rock band, and Flying Caravan, who plays psych folk. Again, that's the 10 Spiders 30 EP release party on Saturday, October 10th at 8 p.m. at the White Eagle Saloon. 836 North Russell Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under community events.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogering. The show is Fight the Empire and Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell is on vacation, and she will be back next week. So I've been filling in for her. It's been a lot of fun. And so we might start out with a few sort of media press, some of the news that's been in the papers lately. One is that Donald Trump, unbelievably, Donald Trump is taking climate change seriously, or more seriously than he did before. Seems that Donald Trump has a hotel and golf course in Doonbeg, Ireland, and he has applied for a special permit to build a 14-foot-high seawall to combat rising sea levels. And so I guess Donald Trump, when it comes to his own property, he will take climate change seriously. So I don't know if he's intending to build some kind of a seawall around his big estate in Florida, Mar-a-Lago. But we will find out, I suppose, in the future. Also in the news, I don't know if it's been reported up here very much, is that California has passed a public banking law, signed into law by Governor Gavin Newsom. And until now, there's only one public bank state bank in the United States, and that was in North Dakota, which is about 100 years old. The thing about a public bank is that it can save taxpayers an awful lot of money. When the voters pass a bond measure, you know, to build a school or do something like that, or highway construction, say they pass a bond measure for $1 million. What that means is that the state, or the whoever the governing body is that in charge of this, they will go to a private bank, and they will borrow that $1 million to fund the project. Well, when you borrow $1 million, you are paying interest on that money, and by the time the $1 million is paid off, the government may have paid out, well, depending on how much interest the banks charge, the government has paid out, or acting for the taxpayers, has paid out well over $1 million, $1.5 million, maybe $2 million, who knows? So, but if you have a state bank or any kind of a public bank, you don't have to go to the private banks. You can go to your local public bank, and if you will be paying interest, I suppose, but the interest stays within the state. It doesn't go out. It doesn't go to Wall Street. Put it that way. So that's a wonderful thing about a public bank, and it saves taxpayers an awful lot of money. I'm surprised that other states haven't done the same thing. I think we should have one here in Oregon. There is a public banking institute, which you can go online and find out more about this topic. It doesn't have to be a state bank. It could be a city bank. It could be a county bank or whatever. But the main thing is that it's a bank that is sort of owned by the taxpayers, and it acts in their behalf. It doesn't spend their money on interest payments to Wall Street bankers or whatever. So the good news is that California now is on the way to having a public bank, and maybe they can set an example for us. Be something to do. I have a guest lined up at 9:30. So if you want to phone in, you have to do it before 9:30. The number to call is 503-231-8187. What do you think about a public bank? I talked to some of our local officials here about it, and they sort of seem mildly interested, but they have, you know, lots of other things on their mind besides that. But I don't know. Do you think we ought to kind of pester our public officials and get a public bank here in Oregon? Also, my guest later on will be Joe Loria, who is the editor of Consortium News. Now, Consortium News is a wonderful source of information. You don't find it elsewhere on the so-called mainstream media. This was Consortium News was started some time ago by reporter Robert Perry, the late Robert Perry, who died last year. He's a wonderful reporter, broke a lot of news stories, and he actually was on this guest on this show once or twice, and he passed away. And Joe Loria, another veteran journalist, has taken over the Consortium News. And like I say, it's a wonderful source of information that you don't find elsewhere. And he will be my guest at 9:30, and we'll be talking about an article he wrote, The untold story of the Trump-Ukraine scandal, the routine corruption of U.S. foreign policy. And the gist of the article is that what Trump is doing in Ukraine is not that new. It's certainly not good. It's bad stuff he's doing, but it kind of fits a pattern of bad stuff that this country has been doing for quite a while. Once again, if you want to call in with your questions or comments before 9:30, the number is 503-231-8187. I think, to me, you know, I've been thinking a lot about Donald Trump. He's such an obvious, odious personality. He's sort of really over the top when it comes to being just sort of nasty and boorish, that people get spooked by him. And I think this is unfortunate because it sort of fits into our two-party system. We have what you might call a binary political system. There's Republicans and there's Democrats, and that is it. And kind of interesting. We're getting away from the binary mode when it comes to gender identities and things like that, but we're still stuck with a binary political setup. And this, we've known about this for quite a while. You know, it's sort of that the two-party system, it sort of inevitably leads to greater evil and lesser evil thinking, that when you only have one of two choices, you sort of automatically gravitate to the one that you think is a lesser evil, because the chances are, for lots of reasons, our political system produces candidates and politicians who are really kind of they're really not that great. They leave a lot to be desired. And so we get stuck in this greater evil, lesser evil way of thinking. We, in my case, say, you know, I've only voted for one Republican in my entire life, and that was Senator Mark Hatfield back in the 70s. Mark Hatfield was kind of an unusual guy. He was a Republican and conservative in many ways, but he was very much anti-war. And one year he was running against a Democrat who is very much pro-war. So I voted for Hatfield, and the sky didn't crack asunder. We're still here. But this is what happens when you have a two-party system. And so with Trump, the greater evil, namely Mr. Trump, has become an over-the-top monster. He is so he is so scary that he has a lot of liberals and progressive people embracing the lesser evil, which in this case are the centrist Democrats, who are very much in league with you know, the war machine and the intelligence community. Right now, Trump is being really he's in a bitter struggle battle with the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community. For their own reasons, they are out to get him. He has interfered with their plans. And when you look at Donald Trump, it's very easy to see what an odious personality he is, and then line up on the side of the CIA, who are generally pretty soft-spoken, polite people. They don't rant and rave about weird topics. They don't express any racism. And so it's very easy to line up with the CIA because Trump is such a greater evil. He's such a monster. Well, when that happens, we can see it happening right now, is that the greater evil tends to become worse and worse all the time. And that sort of makes the lesser evil worse and worse all the time, too. So as you have this over the years, you've had our politics has shifted to the right. And that has given us, that's partly the reason why we're in such a mess right now, that this rightist thinking has really infected the entire political scene. In this country, I suppose it happened with started with Ronald Reagan, but it's happened in Europe too. Started with Margaret Thatcher in England, and what's happened with, you know, you have two political people from the right who have a lot of sway over the voters, that the opposition tends to swing towards the right also. So in this country, you have the Democrats have become more and more Wall Street friendly, put it that way. And in England, you've had the Labour Party under Tony Blair has become more and more friendly to the financiers and the conservatives. And the pro and much more pro-war. It used to be that Democrats were sort of you could count on Democrats for being kind of anti-war. But it's got this curious thing now where a lot of Democrats are much in favor. You know, they do favor wars. They may have a different enemy than Donald Trump. Donald Trump seems to be much fixated on Iran, where the Democrats seem to be more fixated on Russia and Ukraine. So you have, like I said, if you want to call in with comments on that, do you think our two-party system has given us Donald Trump? The number to call is 503-231-8187. The Donald, our system, you know, we may say that that our system is working to put people like Donald Trump in office. He didn't get pushed on us. He got in the White House by playing the rules of our political game. You know, he didn't get as many votes as Hillary Clinton did in 2016, but he got the electoral votes, which the Electoral College is very much part of our system. I think it's a basic flaw in our democracy I think the fifth or sixth time in American history where the candidate for president with the most votes was not elected. And so that's what happened in 2016. Hillary Clinton had almost 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, but he was elected because he had the votes in the Electoral College, and they are the ones that count. I think this is so this is what our system has given us. And so we go around the world kind of touting our system of democracy as something that other countries might follow our example. But I think the fact that Donald Trump is in the White House makes that really much less likely. It's kind of a shame. What kind of an example is the U.S. setting for the rest of the world with this kind of a creepy narcissist in the White House who was put there by our very system. And I think that is one reason why a lot of people, they can't believe it. They have to, they got to blame somebody. And rather than blame our system, they will blame the evil Mr. Putin, and they will conjure up this conspiracy theory that kind of is like the Russians are responsible. It's almost like the devil made us do it. It's based on this idea that the Russians sort of hacked our democracy and put Trump in the White House. It's not true. The fact is that when WikiLeaks released the material from the Democratic National Committee showing that the DNC had actually worked to destroy Bernie Sanders' campaign and put Hillary Clinton as the candidate. And also the WikiLeaks published some of the speeches that Hillary Clinton had made to Wall Street financiers. And this information was not hacked by the Russians. It was leaked by somebody within the Democratic organization. And the evidence for that is provided by a guy named William Binney, who was with the NSA for 30 years. He was their technical director. And he said that these leaked documents, they had timestamps on them, and that they could not have been hacked because the hacking could not have been, it would have taken too much time to hack these documents that were released. It would have to be done by somebody on the inside who, you know, stuck a thumb drive in a computer and downloaded all this stuff and then passed it on to WikiLeaks. Well, this is detailed information. Oh, I might add right now that the information that was leaked is stuff that the public had a right to know about. It's not something that should have been kept secret. The public should know what Hillary said to the Wall Street crowd. The public should know what the DNC had done to screw around with Bernie Sanders' campaign. This is information that that we need to know, and to blame it on the Russians as some kind of evil deed is really very misguided. Might add that person who is partly responsible for getting this information to the public, that's Julian Assange, who is the sort of founder of WikiLeaks. He is in a British prison being held in kind of a sort of like solitary confinement, and he was put there for a term of I believe 50 days or something on a charge that originally emanated from Sweden of some sexual misconduct. Those charges have been dropped by Sweden. And Assange took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy as a kind of seeking asylum, because if he'd been extradited on this Swedish charge, there are good reasons to believe he would have been extradited to the U.S. But we do have a caller on the line. Sad is on. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, thanks for giving this great review, overview, I should say. I just wanted to say, you know, I think this is well-trod ground within certain circles. Certainly not everyone knows about it. I'm glad you're talking about it. I just wanted to bring up a few things that we can do that are working, and a way to change the system. One is, in current events right now, what's happening in Ecuador. I think the general strike there, led by a lot of the poor people there, is being very effective.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. And another thing closer to home is ballot measures. I mean, I think we take it for granted here in Oregon anyway, just how powerful our measure system is, and it's I think nearly unique within the United States. So if people want change, that is a great way to do it.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think I'd love to see a public banking measure on the ballot.
Yep. And then one final thing, exactly what we're doing right now. Local media and local investigative journalism is the way to go. I don't think we can rely on large national or international papers anymore or media outlets. I think it's places like KBOO or Street Roots or any number of local or regional media outlets that are going to make the difference.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your comments.
Yeah.
We have another caller on the line. I think David is on the line.
Right. I think I'd love to see a public banking measure on the ballot.
Yeah. Yep. And one final thing.
David, are you there?
Oh, hello. Sorry. It's just they're playing a different thing on the radio, and then you're quite out of sync.
Yeah. I was hearing my own voice on the phone, so not good. So, yeah.
Well, first off, public bank.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I certainly would endorse the public banking system. Glad you brought that up. But I wanted to call in to mention another factor in the elections that certainly deserves to be mentioned. I would guess it's the preeminent factor, which was the cross-check system that Chris Kobach, Secretary of State of Kansas, ran, that was spread across the country, claiming. I guess millions of voters in all kinds of various states were ineligible to vote because supposedly they're double voters in other states just based on some bizarre, name matching scheme where, Hank Williams in Georgia, well, there's also a Henry K. Williams in, Ohio, so well, you must be a double voter, sir.
Yes, has to be.
More likely, I should have given them the hypothetical person, say, a Hispanic surname or an Asian surname, because that's a whole part of the scam. It's a bit too much to go into, I'm sure, in detail just now, but Greg Kolas has gone into it. But, I mean, I've been surprised at how much attention the media gives to Russian hacking, which may or may not have happened or whatever, but it's a known fact. According to, given Greg Kolas' reporting, it's a known fact that the wins in several states like Ohio and other Midwestern states, Ohio, I think there were 600,000 people knocked off the voting rolls seriously, and then Trump won by 10 or 15,000 votes.
Mm-hmm.
This should be headline news, and it never has been headline news. The sort of thing has been going on since 2000, and even then, the press sat on it. Even though Kolas was getting headlines in England and in Europe, the U.S. press has just consistently sat on these sorts of stories. I mean, hey, this thing that I've talked about, this election got a few stories. It's never gotten headlines, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's been on this. He's been on KBOO quite often. He's a frequent guest when Joanne Hardesty had her talk show.
Oh, yeah, he's on KBOO.
KBOO
is such a... so invisible to, most people never heard of KBOO.
Well, they should. We're doing our best. And
I fully agree. I'm just saying that the corporate media seems to be studiously avoiding this linchpin of how Republicans are winning offices. This vote suppression and the details of it are really not talked about enough. So,
well, it's like they've got the big megaphone.
Yeah, I certainly do.
Well, anyway, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, that kind of highlights another thing with our political system, that, voters have been knocked off the rolls. In some cases, they've been it's been made very hard for them to even get to the voting booth. You know, I mean, you find a very curious thing happens where in poor and working class neighborhoods, there are not enough voting precincts to handle the crowd. So you have these long, long lines where people wait maybe hours to cast their ballot. And here in Oregon, we have a voting by mail, so you can, you know, you don't have to stand in line unless you want to. But this is another way that system is kind of, you know, rigged the election by making it hard for people, working people, and poor people to vote. It's very easy if you're, you know, if you live in one of the wealthy suburbs, you can get to the. You can get to the ballot very. You can get to the voting booth readily, but not everywhere. But right now we have our guest. He's Joe Loria, who is the editor of Consortium News. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, pretty good. Tell us a little bit about Consortium News. I mentioned a little bit earlier in the show, and it was started by Robert Parry a number of years ago.
Yeah, that's right. It was started in 1995, which many people believe is the earliest independent news website ever created. The internet in 1995 was pretty much still in its infancy. So that's kind of ancient history for the internet. And Bob Parry was an investigative reporter, a real investigative reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Spent months on one story, reading thousands of documents and interviewing dozens and dozens of people. And he worked at AP, and he learned of this man called Oliver North in the basement of the White House, who was organizing the illegal sale of weapons to Iran. And this is after the revolution in Iran. So the great enemy of Iran, the U.S. sold weapons through an Israeli middleman, and the proceeds from those sales were used to fund illegally the Contras in Nicaragua, illegally because Congress had cut off funding, and in the Constitution, only the Congress can appropriate funds, not the White House. So this operation, Iran-Contra, as it became to be known, was pretty much discovered by Bob Parry and his partner at the Associated Press, but the AP spiked that story. They kept making him go back and do more research, and they eventually did not want to run it because it would be too embarrassing to the U.S., but by mistake, it was published on the Spanish wire of AP, so they had to publish it in English, and that's how Bob got that story out. But this happened to him repeatedly at AP, then also at Newsweek, so he got fed up and started a consortium of journalists who were getting their articles spiked and suppressed by corporate media to publish online on his website. That's the birth of Consortium News in 1995 by Bob Parry. Bob died last January 2018. I took over on April 1st, 2018 as the editor-in-chief, only the second one ever, of course, of this website. I'd been writing for Bob 6 years previous to that. So now I'm running the show, and we've started a webcast called CN Live, which broadcasts every Friday night, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And we've delved into numerous subjects. You can find our YouTube channel on YouTube and watch the past episodes.
Well, I've been telling our listeners that it's a wonderful source that for news that you don't get elsewhere. It's been my impression that there have been more and more people writing for Consortium News lately. Is that true?
We have a core writers, some of them who were writing before Bob passed away, who continue to write for us. And we have Asad Abu Khalil, the so-called angry Arab, who writes about the Middle East for us. We have Pepe Escobar writing original articles for us.
Mm-hmm.
We have Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern, of course, continues to be a mainstay and an important part of Consortium News, as he was with Bob for over the last decade or so. So these are the kinds of people we have writing for us. We also republish some of the most important articles from in agreements we have with writers that are found across the internet. So yes, it's you'll find 2 to 3, sometimes more, original and republished articles every day. And of course, we cover a range of issues, mostly focused on foreign policy, but not exclusively. Bob did some of the earliest anti-Russiagate stories that ever existed. Aaron Matei, who went on to do some of the more important ones and rightly gets credit for debunking the Russiagate narrative, and now that that's been settled when Robert Mueller found no collusion between Trump campaign and Russia, he's credited Bob Perry and Consortium News as being one of the first, if not the first, to really pick apart this mania that we went through for a couple of years about Russia and Trump, etc., Russiagate. So that is probably the greatest achievement of Consortium News, but there have been many, unraveling the Ukrainian coup d'etat in 2014 that the U.S. backed. Has been another big issue that Bob Perry wrote about, chemical weapons use in Syria, the MH17. Bob did a lot of investigations on that. So we deal with the largest, mostly international issues, but certainly domestic ones as well. We are completely nonpartisan, and I mean that. And it's easy for me, particularly, to be nonpartisan because I dislike intensely both major parties. So it's not, I find it hard to support one over the other. We are very critical of both Republicans and the Democrats, and we don't spare anybody.
Well, we've been talking early before you came on. I've been talking about this kind of binary political system we have that leads to sort of lesser evil voting, and seems like over the years the greater evil has gotten more and more evil, until we have Donald Trump, who is kind of the supreme monster, and gotten people so spooked that they are running into the arms of the CIA.
Well, the lesser evil has gotten much more evil as well.
That's so, right.
Both sides are horrendous. The CIA's role now openly in the domestic politics is something shocking to behold. Not that they didn't have influence, but much more behind the scenes for decades, ever since it began by Truman in 1947. CIA is supposedly, by its charter, by law, is not allowed to operate inside the U.S., but of course it has and it does. And it, in the 1950s, of course, had Operation I'm forgetting the name right now, where they got involved in directly in planting stories in the media, paying journalists to Mockingbird, Operation Mockingbird. The CIA doesn't have to pay journalists anymore. They seem more willing than ever to transmit the CIA's message to anonymous leaks from intelligence sources without vetting what they are. There's a gullibility, there is a naivete, perhaps there's certainly even a cynicism amongst reporters that report what the CIA's vision of the world is, and their version of what's going on. And this is so troubling, to see the CIA being vaulted and being openly, now they, as you know, as your listeners know, MSNBC, CNN, the others have hired former intelligence agents, including John Brennan, former director, to actually be on-the-air analysts.
Mm-hmm.
They're no longer in the shadows now. And I know we don't have the time to go into it, but there's no question that the investigation that the Justice Department is doing, led by the Attorney General and Mr. John Durham, who's a Attorney General in a district attorney rather in Connecticut, to look into the origins of Russiagate, it seems to have gotten a lot in the CIA and in the FBI about what role they may have played in ginning up the Russiagate story, using surveillance to get a FISA court warrant to listen in to campaign officials of the Trump campaign, and they pushed the opposition research document from Christopher Steele, the former MI6 agent. It was not an intelligence report. It was a paid for by the Democrats, paid for opposition research, but that was elevated to some kind of truth, and we now know that most of that was a lie, because that's what the opposition research is. But it became the basis for this attack on a guy that we certainly don't support, Donald Trump. But the principle involved here is that intelligence agencies shouldn't be getting involved in domestic politics so openly as they are right now. And it could be, it looks like, that this investigation by Barr and Durham are making these people nervous. So the CIA actually had an officer that is seconded to the White House to give intelligence to the National Security Council. It's an official position. It's been there for years. But it looks like that the man from the or woman from the CIA that had that post became this so-called whistleblower, which makes a mockery of the way the government treats real whistleblowers by imprisoning them and destroying their lives when they reveal information on behalf of the nation against the establishment. This is an establishment figure who's supposedly whistleblowing against Trump, who, if indeed he withheld military aid from Ukraine until they investigated the origins of Russiagate, if Ukraine had a role, and certainly the Joe Biden and his son's activity inside Ukraine, that was spoken about. We saw the transcript. If Trump did that, it's not 100% clear that he was using this. There's not a clear quid pro quo, but that's the normal routine way the U.S. conducts foreign policy. And then a recent article I wrote in Conservative News, I laid out some examples. Before the first Gulf War, there were countries threatened of a withdrawal of aid if they didn't vote to support the first Gulf War against Iraq, and indeed Yemen did not vote for it, so they lost $70 million in aid as a direct consequence. And before the second invasion of Iraq, we know from Catherine Gunn, the GCHQ whistleblower, who's, they've made a film of historical official secrets. I urge people to see it. She revealed that the National Security Agency in the U.S. was spying on the missions of the Security Council members to get leverage so that they would vote for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Well, they didn't, and the U.S. invaded anyway without a Security Council authorization. And when the U.S. was worried about the International Criminal Court perhaps charging their soldiers with war crimes, there was pressure put on many, many countries to conclude bilateral deals giving immunity to U.S. soldiers. Otherwise, aid would be withdrawn. So, and then Julian Assange, pressure was put on Ecuador to end his asylum, turn him over to the British police, which Ecuador did. And then just after that, they got a huge IMF loan, which the U.S. has enormous control over what the IMF does, of course. So these are examples of how the routine way the U.S. conducts foreign policy. And Joe Biden himself, there's a video out there, said in a Council on Foreign Relations conference that he went into Ukraine and he told the president, then Poroshenko, who was installed after the coup, that if he didn't fire this prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, who was indeed investigating Biden and his son and this company, rather, the company that Biden's son was installed on right after the coup, Burisma Holdings, the largest gas producer in Ukraine, if he wasn't fired, they wouldn't get a $1 billion U.S. credit line. And indeed, within 6 hours, as Biden tells, the prosecutor was fired. They got the money. This is the way U.S. conducts foreign policy: threats, bribes, intimidation. So Biden openly admits this. And we've got a corporate media right now that is running interference for Biden and just repeating constantly over and over like a mantra that this is a conspiracy theory that Biden did anything wrong in Ukraine, when there are serious questions about what he did in Ukraine and it needs to be investigated. Trump's really big blunder was to get on the phone and get personally involved in this. There should be a wall between the White House and the Justice Department, so the pursuit of law and law enforcement is not and prosecution is not tainted by political motives. So, but Trump stupidly gets on there and says, you know, why don't you investigate Biden? And yeah, well, you know, we have this military aid for you. So, I mean, he should never have gotten involved. That opened himself up to this attack by the Democrats, by the CIA official inside the White House, who they're portraying as a whistleblower. And Trump allowed the Democrats and the intelligence agencies to now take this possible infraction, which I say is routine and par for the course, into an impeachable offense. So this is a huge mistake on his part.
Well, tell us about now. Hunter Biden got a seat on the board of Burisma. We get paid something like $50,000 a month for being on the board.
Well, I have seen different figures, so I've not quoted any amount. I've seen $60,000, $50,000, $100,000. He got a lot of money. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. But that's really unimportant how much money he made. What's important here is to put the context in which he got this job. In February of 2014, the U.S. Helped lead a violent revolution that overthrew an elected president. A corrupt guy, but everybody in Ukraine seems to be corrupt in the political class, one of the most corrupt political classes anywhere. It's well up there with Nigeria, and I must say the United States, for being totally corrupt political system. But Viktor Yanukovych was the president, and there were violent demonstrations, and we know the U.S. was involved in several ways. And they keep denying this, the corporate media, that there was any coup there. They won't mention this. Fox News won't mention it. This bipartisan cover-up of the U.S. role in overthrowing governments. That's the way they have done it for years. We only learned about the U.S. regime change, really, until 25 years after documents are declassified, like in Chile, for example. New York Times said, oh, well, the U.S. got CIA was involved in overthrowing Salvador Allende, a democratically elected president. We only learned that 25 years later. So right now they're covering this up. And the evidence is, number one piece of evidence is that Victoria Nuland, the Undersecretary of State for Europe and Eurasian Affairs, was on the phone with Jeffrey Piot, who was then the ambassador to Ukraine from the United States. And this was at least a month or more before the overthrow of Yanukovych, talking about who would take over the new government. They were discussing this, and they also say, and this is on YouTube, anybody can go and see it, somebody intercepted it, most likely the Russian intelligence, they put it on YouTube. So anybody can listen to this conversation, and she says there that Joe Biden is going to glue the thing together, basically, that Biden played a key role in this coup d'etat. This is very important to understand this story. The other evidence is that Nuland herself and John McCain and Piot, the ambassador, were down in the ground on Maidan Square handing out cookies and cakes to the protesters. Now, just imagine during the Occupy Wall Street that a Russian minister in charge of North American affairs flew in from Moscow and started handing out cakes and food to the protesters in Zuccotti Park in New York. What would the reaction be? Mm. And then, let's say, and none of that, they didn't have an intercepted call where this guy is talking a couple of months before who they were going to place Obama with, right? Mm-hmm. Then this violent uprising and Obama's overthrown. This is exactly what happened. And then, 2 months later, after the U.S. has succeeded in helping, that there was legitimate protest against Yanukovych, there's no question about it. The U.S. doesn't even make up these regime changes, these coups out of cloth. There's always resistance and unrest and dissatisfaction in every society. There are protesters, so you build them up, you organize them, you pay for their media.
Well, you know what it makes me think of? It reminds me of these kind of corporate vultures, vulture capitalists. They find some corporation that's in having problems, and they kind of swoop in on it, and they kind of take it over, and then they just destroy it. So I think our government sort of does the same thing with troubled economies, troubled nations. They kind of come in, and then they take a bad situation and make it worse.
Well, not for their interest, not for the interest of American ruling elite. There's also, of course, a geostrategic part of this in Ukraine, because, as Brzezinski wrote, Ukraine is sort of the gateway to Eurasia. Mm-hmm. It's a key country to Russia. To weaken Russia, Ukraine had to come into the Western camp. And this was the mistake, quote-unquote, that Yanukovych made. Rather than take a European Union deal as a bailout, he took a Russian deal because the terms were better. And that is when they put this coup into operation. So the coup takes place, and 2 months later, Biden, who played a key role in it, according to Victoria Nuland's own words in that leaked tape, he puts his son winds up on the board of a gas company there. John Kerry, who was the Secretary of State at the time, a family friend, gets on that same board. Monsanto gets a contract, agricultural contract in Ukraine. So these are the spoils of a coup. It's like a 19th century colonial operation. Mm-hmm. You take over a government, you put a stooge in power, it's not direct rule from the United States, it's indirect, and then you spread around the wealth to your friends. And this is so obviously corrupt, what Biden did, that needs to be investigated. How did his son wind up on this board, and why was it only after this coup? But if you excise the coup from the corporate media reporting, which they do, you don't understand that. And then you've got the Democratic media saying, conspiracy theory, because there's no evidence that Biden did anything wrong. There hasn't been the investigation yet. So sure, there's no evidence now. They don't want that investigation. They want to impeach Trump. And I just saw the news right now, before I went on the air with you, that two people associated to Giuliani have been arrested for campaign, and the way it was written, associated with Giuliani's investigation in Ukraine, of Biden's activities and of Russiagate's origins. And of course, Giuliani is the private lawyer of Donald Trump, the president, and he's there to try to protect his client. So he wants to get the dirt on what happened with Russiagate, and he's investigating this legitimately. But Trump has tainted everything Giuliani does, or Barr does, by getting personally involved, as I mentioned. So it's tainted as political, but it's not. I mean, we hope that it's not, but even if it is, there were perhaps, there is corruption there, it looks like. It needs to be investigated. So after the coup, Biden's son gets this incredible job, and the prosecutor was looking into it, and Biden had him fired, and he boasted he had him fired by withholding $1 billion in credit to Ukraine's government. That's mm-hmm. the way the U.S. conducts, the bullying way the U.S. conducts foreign policy. So even if Trump did say, you know, imply he would hold the military aid, that's the way the U.S. conducts their diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. Who is a family friend of John Kerry?
Well, I don't remember his name. Oh, Archer. David Archer, I think.
Oh, Devin Archer. This is very interesting because a story just came out from Interfax that says that Joe Biden was personally paid $900,000 from Burisma. And this was an accusation by a Ukrainian member of parliament named Andriy Derkach.
That's fascinating. I would love to see the evidence.
This just came out. It was reported by Zero Hedge, and they got it from Interfax. Now Interfax, I think, is a Russian private. It's a private news agency in Russia. They sort of deal with financial stuff a lot, and I think they have contacts with Western financial analysts. But that's what the story says, that Burisma paid Joe Biden $900,000 and for lobbying activities, and a total of $16.5 million went to this Polish former president Aleksander Kwasniewski, and also an investment banker Alan Apter, Devin Archer, and Hunter Biden. So they all got money from this. It looks like another money deal going on here besides the one we've been talking about before.
Well, I don't know anything about it. As you just said, it just broke, and I'd have to see the evidence of that, because that's an easy accusation to make. But if that's true, I mean, he'll be cooked. He'll be cooked. And don't hold on to your hats, because if Biden has to drop out of this thing, he's already showing signs of early dementia. There's no question about that. I don't mean to be rude about this. The guy does not look like he's got all his marbles anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's already causing concern. But if this is true and he's brought down, don't be surprised if another centrist comes in and says, look, I was robbed last time, and now he's impeached. Let's say they impeach him without convicting him. He's wounded. I was stolen. The Russians stole the election from me, and Hillary Clinton just has to come in, because you're all great candidates, but none of you are going to beat Trump. And I'm telling you, don't be surprised if Hillary is not making moves in the background if Biden falls. I just see this article now from Zero Hedge, so I'll take a look at that.
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton is she's coming to she and Chelsea have written some kind of book, and they're going on a nationwide tour. They're coming to Portland, is it later this month or sometime pretty soon? And I think she made some remark that, I don't know if she's kind of being joking or what, like, I'm ready or something like that. But this is my big concern, is that that Trump definitely looks like he's on the way out. And I'm thinking, what comes after Trump? I mean, it's he's such a loudmouth, bullying kind of a person that anybody who sort of speaks softly and is polite can get away with a lot of malfeasance. So that's my fear, that we're going to get some very polite warmonger to replace Donald Trump.
Yeah, that could be Hillary Clinton. You heard it here first. No, I'm joking. But I've been ridiculed by people for thinking I've been saying if she can walk, she's going to run in 2019. And of course, she had a hard time standing up, as we know. Last time, she had health problems that became an issue. So it was a little joke of mine that she will run if she can. CNN actually ran a story yesterday, I believe, in which they were saying she's joking, right? She's not really running. But asking the question, is she wanting to run? Because she's been taunting Donald Trump. When apparently Trump tweeted out to her, why don't you come back in against me? And she said, don't tempt me. So, I mean, she's dying to. CNN said she would like to be president. She's dying to be president.
Mm-hmm.
This is her whole life's ambition, clearly. And if she could find an opening in here, now there's still a lot of distaste amongst a lot of Democratic voters, let alone the rest of the country, against her. But if she, by impeaching Trump would, I think, help her strengthen her argument that this was a bum, he is a bum, but the Russians did not steal the election for her. She lost it on her own, with her own horrible policies and her bad campaigning, not going to those important states in the Midwest and calling Trump voters deplorable and et cetera. She made so many blunders in that campaign, and she sabotaged Bernie Sanders' primary that we now know from the emails that WikiLeaks published, and therefore she's someone who the voters rejected in the states that counted, that had the electoral votes she needed, despite winning by 3 million popular votes. So I think that she could easily re-enter this race as soon as Biden drops out. Now I'm looking at the article you mentioned, and we've got quoting that this lawmaker in Ukraine has documents. He publicized documents that shows a transfer of $900,000 to a U.S. company called Rosemont Seneca Partners, which, according to open sources in New York, including the New York Times, is affiliated with Biden, with Joe Biden. I mean, if this can be proven, that the New York Times and CNN and the New Yorker, and I just wrote a piece picking apart an article by Jane Meyer in the New Yorker saying Biden did nothing wrong, there's no evidence, it's a right-wing conspiracy theory. But if this can be proven with documents that Biden took $900,000 from this company, I mean, come on.
Well,
after he was vice president.
I wonder if Adam Schiff might be aiming higher. He's making a big splash now with the impeachment campaign. I've read some of his statements. He's as much a warmonger as any of them.
I'm sorry that man is. He looks like he's possessed by a demon. It's his eyes. He's a really awful legislator. Let's put it that way. He's an unscrupulous, lying person who was one of the biggest cheerleaders for Russiagate, and went on the record saying, we have direct evidence of Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. And Robert Mueller found zero evidence of collusion between Russia and the campaign. And he just got away with it. He got away with lying like that. It's awful.
Well, it's like one thing that's been, before you came on, I was talking a little bit about, William Binney's evidence about that the DNC material was leaked and not hacked. And he's been, William Binney, a credible person, has been just totally ignored by the mainstream media.
Well, worse than that, Bill Binney, of course, was a former National Security Agency technical director. He was one of the leading mathematicians ever at the National Security Agency. And Bill wrote, with the rest of the Veterans Intelligence Professionals Society, that memo in July of 17 or 18, I can't remember now, in Conservative News. We published their memos, and we are the depository of what they write. And my argument is, it doesn't matter who the whether it was leak or hack. It really doesn't matter. Why? Because WikiLeaks has put out an anonymous donor box that anyone around the world can put classified information or any other information. WikiLeaks doesn't want to know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the important thing is the documents. They had the documents.
Mm-hmm.
The motive doesn't count. You got the documents. Anyway,
we are at the end of our show. We've been talking with Joe Loria, the editor of Consortium News. And I really recommend Consortium. Read it. There's lots of information there. And while you're reading it, drop them a few dollars to keep them going. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Joe Loria. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye now.
Stay tuned. It's KBOO. It's your radio station, folks.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next after these messages at 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein exploring the life and times of CIA poisoner-in-chief Sidney Gottlieb. At 11, it's Between the Covers. David Naiman interviews poet Rob Schlegel about his book, In a Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, SW Concert has conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.FM or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programs? Then download our mobile app today. This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a public affairs director to manage public affairs programming, ensuring that it is of the highest quality and consistent with the KBOO programming charter. For this 32 hours position, we are looking for someone with production experience, experience in community radio, who has communication and training skills, and the ability to work independently in a fast-paced work environment. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Deadline to apply is Friday, October 25th at 5 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/PADHIRE2019.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host the third annual Dia de los Muertos celebration on Thursday, October 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. We'll be showing short films recognizing the traditional practices and beliefs of El Día de los Muertos as practiced in Mexico, Ecuador, Nicaragua, and Bolivia. We'll also have dancing, food, and music to honor our beloved dead. Again, that's the third annual Día de los Muertos celebration on Thursday, October 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information...